on Saturday, and now we'll kind of look back and put a big bow on the Triple Crown season. Tom, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you? It was great to see you the other day.
It was good to see you, and you were in full conversation with Michael Blowen as much as anybody gets to converse. Usually it's Michael, holding court.
Yeah, that was actually my third conversation of the day with Michael. The first was maybe 2 hours earlier, then the next was about an hour after that, and then that one with you. It was a good. You took a good picture of me. It was kind of a flattering picture. I haven't, during COVID, I don't have a lot of flattering photos, and suddenly now I have a good one. So I was pretty excited. So thank you for sharing that with me.
You're quite welcome, and I'll put it up. I'm sure today with the with today's listings when I put it, the list of visitors for the show today, and for Michael, I'm so eager. Yeah. I can't wait till he gets this news and we can publicize it, because we have two connections between Michael and then the horse and who the horse was owned and campaigned by. So I'm particularly excited about their latest acquisition. But I don't want to call it success because it's not a business, but the success of Old Friends as a concept, as an entity, has really been remarkable. And the fact that he's turned the retired horse concept into a destination, into an activity, and essentially a tourist destination, is remarkable. And the idea has spread. I mean, there's more of this concept that is finding purchase, and it started innocently enough, as his film critic career was winding down at the Globe, and his love for the game. I mean, it's so infectious. He's just amazing.
Yeah. He's just I always have a great time with Michael. I can remember when he was kind of just getting started out there at Hurstland Farm and Alfred Knuckles, and then of course he moves to Georgetown, Kentucky, which ironically, or maybe not ironically, but has since kind of really risen in stature. It's really one of the most growing places there in Lexington. I mean, you have the Toyota plant that's there that employs thousands of people.
Yeah.
And Georgetown, and I obviously have a lot of connections still back in Kentucky from my days there. Everybody that I talk to is like, Georgetown's just growing and the real estate's going nuts. And of course, Michael's right there in the heart of Georgetown. And yeah, like you said, you said the word tourist attraction. That while you were talking, I was just thinking, yeah, he's created like a real tourist kind of destination. And it really is. I mean, people just come and want to see those horses. And yeah, he's got some cool news coming up. Certainly not gonna dig into my reporter roots and scoop him by any means. But the little tease maybe for what he's got coming down the pipe. Maybe maybe even listening, I'm sure.
He listens frequently.
That's what we think. Yeah.
That's funny. When this news hits, we'll get the owner on, and Michael's in the process of bringing somebody home, which has become part of his, part of his role, really. I mean, he's keeping track of stallions whose careers come to an end. I mean, the whole concept of creating a home for pensioned stallions, that was, for those that don't really remember the origin, and we bring it up every so often with Michael when we visit, but the original idea was the care and attention for what is typically a difficult, a difficult animal. It's not easy. And for those that say, well, why don't they just geld them at 20? You don't geld 22-year-olds. It's a that's problematic. I've had Dr. Alday explain that. But, you know, the health issues of advanced age pension stallions is unique. And this was a crazy concept for Michael, and it ended up being a home run.
Yeah, I can remember, you know, covering sort of the stallion industry back in, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. And I remember having a sort of a long, detailed conversation with Will Farish at Lane's End Farm about Pleasant Colony. And, you know, they were pensioning him, and, you know, he was having some health-related issues. And, you know, he was older. He was an older stallion. And, you know, he kind of looked like they weren't really sure what they were going to do with him. They sent him to a farm in Virginia where he was cared for, and you know, they had him at Lane's End for a while. I apologize for that dog barking in the background. But, you know, and that, this was before Michael had his thing going. So, yeah, it's a great thing for racing, and, you know, really a lot of fun. I know Michael has a lot of fun with it, and, you know, his enthusiasm is just infectious. And I feel like every time I run into him, he's always like, hey, I got some news. I got this horse coming. I got that horse coming. It's like every time, you know. So it's like he is constantly busy and constantly adding horses to kind of his roster.
Yes.
And his all-star team there that he has there at Old Friends.
Exactly right. And, you know, what's nice, too, is that it's constantly, you know, the roster is there's turnover, and you know, when you're taking on horses, and he's taken on younger horses in recent years that are going to be there forever, and, you know, be there for 10, 15, 20 years even. And, you know, as opposed to the ones that, you know, started out there at age 23, 24, 26 and only have a few years. But, you know, one, when I've been out there twice, and seeing Gulch was a huge thrill.
Yeah. I bet. Know, yeah.
That's
Michael really,
with.
You know, he really puts a lot into it, you know, not just sort of with his hard work, but like with his emotions. And one thing I'll never forget, you know, during my first kind of go around as the president of the National Turf Riders and Broadcasters, we honored Old Friends with an award in 2010. We had the event at the Louisville Slugger Museum right there in downtown Louisville, and Michael was there, and I think it was shortly after maybe Black Tie Affair had passed away, and that was really one of his favorites. And he was so emotional at that event that it was just real genuine emotion that you could really tell. And of course, he was early on, you know, he's been going at it now for more than a decade since. I mean, it's you can't hide it, you know what I mean? You can't fake it, you know. It was really, you could really see it, what it meant to him, and you know, getting choked up while people were even introducing him and talking about some of the horses that he's had there over the years that had passed away. And it was a cool moment. So it was obviously a lot of fun to hang out with him at Belmont. I hadn't seen him since I didn't see him in Kentucky this year when I was there, and I hadn't really seen him since the Pegasus back in 2020, which was kind of like my last work trip prior to this year's Triple Crown, which I was really thankful to be able to get back on the road for all three races this year, like you, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, and the Belmont was the appropriate place to see. To see him, because he's got what? He's got Sarava, he's got Birdstone.
Yeah. Silver Charm.
Silver Charm, that's right.
Showdown, Yeah. Good stuff.
Well, oldfriendsequine.org for those that, if you're going to be in any direction this summer, you're going, I don't know, Tennessee, or you're going wherever you're headed, coming up to Cincinnati or whatever.
Yeah.
Stop and see Old Friends. You'll absolutely enjoy it. And you can tell Michael's thrilled that, you know, tours have resumed and he can have people through, and it's really one of the great second career or you know, aftercare success stories around the game. Well, Tom, let's have a companion conversation to Thursday's visit. And I did not go back to the Saturday page after we talked about the Friday analysis. I didn't go back for Saturday, but how did you and how did everybody make out?
I think I might have talked about by my standards on the in the Met Mile.
Yeah.
I was pleased with his performance. I thought he ran really well to be second. Kind of a cool horse that can, go one turn or two turns. Of course, the winner, Silver State, he's in the same boat. Oaklawn Handicap winner, cuts back to a mile. He's on a good win streak right now for Steve Asmussen, who's really got a hammer lock on the Met Mile now, three out of the last four.
That's amazing.
Somebody like Steve who really respects kind of the history of the game and speaks very highly of kind of its traditions, I know it means a lot to him. And it was a really cool win for him. And Ricardo Santana, of course, the day before, the day after you and I talked, he's involved in a mishap there at Churchill Downs, and it's like, Irad Ortiz lost his chance to ride Belmont Weekend, and then of course it looked like Santana might lose the chance with a spill there involving the rail, but he ended up being okay and made the trip up to New York and was able to ride Silver State in the Met Mile, and of course he rode in the Belmont and rode in some other races on the card. But just one of the several cool stories on the day. I came away really impressed with doing a little bit of backtrack right now because I'm doing a piece for the Irish Field newspaper. The Clancy's and I kind of do a weekly piece for them and kind of looking back at the Belmont Day, and they like to look at some of the races that maybe are of interest to their Irish readers. And writing about domestic spending right now. I wrote about him on our website, This Is Horse Racing, on Friday, and then writing about him again, and looking back, I've written about him several times, of course, back at Saratoga last year, Saratoga Derby. I mean, he was very impressive in the Manhattan, and I thought he might be. He was obviously favored and not giving away anything, but I talked to Chad Brown after the Turf Classic at Churchill. He and I were in the chute, ready to do the walkover. He was kind of waiting for his horse for the Derby, highly motivated, and we chatted a little bit, and he kind of was like, I think maybe he was a little further back than I would have liked. He wasn't far back, distance wise, but he was kind of buried in the field there and kind of really made a really nice run to get up with Colonel Liam to have that dead heat. And then I Flavian Pratt was riding him again. I thought, he learned a little something about him. It's a mile and a quarter. Chad's got a couple other horses in there. He's going to make sure that there's a good pace. And he just ran a really lights out race in there. Of course, Chad winning the Manhattan for the seventh time since 2012, which is really remarkable as well. It talked about Steve winning the Met Mile. Chad's won three in a row now in the Manhattan. And this horse has only been beaten once in his career. He's, the leader in the turf division now in the U.S. for sure. And, I think he can maybe pick and choose which direction he wants to go, whether he wants to go the mile in the Breeders' Cup down the road or even try the three turns in the Breeders' Cup turf. A long way between now and Del Mar in November, but certainly on the right track. And, Chad's one of the guys to get him to go there. So, and then you had of course, Casa Creed winning the going 1-2 with chewing gum for Bill Mott and in the Jack Pocket Draper, which is always kind of a cool race on the card. Lee spoke a little bit after the race to our Paul Halloran, who's a writer for us, about losing his son and what this win meant to him. And I ran into the Bill Mott in the paddock after the race, and he was kind of like, it's a lot of fun. He goes, I love training horses. I love being around horses, but to be able to win for a guy like Lee, it means a lot to me. And I know that it means a lot to him. And, it's really kind of a nice statement that Bill made. And, you know, he's a guy that I really respect. And I know you do, you know, most people. He needs no introduction, but, you know, always good to see him win a big race on a big day. You know, and all that kind of led into the Belmont Stakes, which, you know, provided a great end to a kind of a strange Triple Crown, but a Triple Crown nonetheless that really produced a lot of pretty awesome finishes. You know, he had the four-horse blanket finish kind of in the Derby, and then Whitey McCarthy breaking through in the Preakness with the Homebred. Horse ran, Ron Bauer ran huge, and then, of course, you know, the two horses that really were, you know, stand out best in the Belmont, you know, really separating themselves from the rest of the field. That mile and a half is great. You know, it's such an equalizer for, you know, no secret that it's a stamina race, but, you know, they turn for home and you can really tell who's going the wrong direction. And, you know, they finished 11 some odd lengths in front of Ron Bauer, you know, who's the Preakness winner. And for those two to do that well in there and to just kind of Hot Rod Charlie kind of throwing it down and Essential Quality kind of running him down and looking at one point like, you know, he was kind of not really, you know, he wasn't like backpedaling by any means, but maybe just a little swimming out there on the turn. I thought, wow, you know, maybe it's not Essential Quality's day. And then he kind of just clicked and grinded it away, just like Brad Cox, you know, predicted that he was a tappet, you know, looked like a Belmont horse from the moment he saw him, in his words, and proved right. In a real good renewal, you know, I mean, the 1-2 in the Breeders' Cup, and then all these months later, 1-2 again in the Belmont. You know, you wouldn't have predicted that. I don't think you'd ever predict that.
No. No,
that's a cool outcome. Yeah.
You're right. You're right about that. Yeah. And it's funny because we had said how after Derby and after Preakness about how just reaching for my chart. Because you made me think of a couple different sidebars. That, you know, that the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, you know, has you know, been a
very
key race.
Race.
I mean, it's very strange for us to be this far along, halfway through, you know, 6 months later, and to have, you know, the Juvenile, you know, back, you know, as the race that you look to. It's pretty remarkable. It's great. You know, and you also, I want to slip in, you, when you talk about the history of the Met. There's a couple of interesting things that Asmussen is doing. He didn't necessarily equal the unique three-peat, the retiring of a trophy, as they say in racing. But there's been three occasions in the past century. Sam Hildreth won three in a row, and John Gaver did as well. But Gaver actually did it all with Devil Diver, 43, 44, and 45. And even Hildreth in 21 and 22 with Mad Hatter, and then in 23 with Grey Lag. The closest, really, is Eddie Neloy with Gunbo, Bold Lad, and Buck Passer, 65, 66, and 67. Three different horses in 3 years. I mean, and Steve has done it, you know, three times in 4 years with George Weaver interloping with Vekoma. Yeah. But he's done it with three different, not just three different horses, but three different owners, which is kind of cool. Fipke, right? Fipke, the Heilingbrotz, and Winchell, and Mr. Horton, and B. Jersey Mottoli, and Silver State. It's pretty amazing. You know, Hildreth did it with Earl Sandy all three times for Rancocas. Neloy's, I'm not sure about Neloy's wins, if they were all, if they were, I'm going to have to go
maybe
back.
Fifth,
well, obviously,
right? Yeah.
Well, Buckpasser would be the Phipps, but no, three different Phipps, of course, and for Bold Lad, Wheatley Stable, and Gunbo, Gedney Farm.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, we're talking Hildreth, Gaver, Neloy. You mentioned those three names. any of your listeners are into history and into racing history, look up those three guys and see what kind of races they won in their careers. You know, and Steve, obviously member of the Hall of Fame along with them, ranks right up there. And, you know, that's pretty remarkable.
Gaver has the record, actually, with six. For those that are wondering, you know, is Asmussen, you know, knocking on the door? Well, Gaver actually started that run with Third Degree for Green Tree and Eddie Arcaro. Yeah. That was in 1940. Then came Devil Diver, who was outstanding.
Yeah.
Then Tom Fool. Tom Fool won it in 53 with Katie May's grandfather, Ted Atkinson.
Yeah.
The last one came with, who was the last one? Cyrano with Bobby Ussery for Green Tree.
Yeah. 63. It's from 1940 to 1963.
It's a spread. Right?
Yeah, right? I mean, you got to go, like, who won it 24 years ago from now? You know, I mean, in what? Was that 1997? You know, Lang Fuhrer, Mike Keogh. You know, Richard Mandela won it in 98. So you might have guys like that, you know, that it could be popping back up. But a lot of guys are deceased from that long ago. So you look at... but, you know what? Steve Asmussen certainly could definitely be in the hunt.
He's,
you know,
yeah, he's going to be around for a while yet.
Young
yeah.
guy. Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. I don't think of him as, I think of him as a, you know, a, my generation. I mean, he's a little bit older than me, but, you know, not much.
Well, you know who else deserves a mention in this in terms of a spread? Bobby Frankel won with Garthorn in 86 for Jerry Moss. And then it was a few years, you and I, for Mr. Gann with Choppy. Yeah. That was 95. Came back and won it with Aldebaran for Flaxman in 03. Yeah. And then won his fourth one, of course, with Gosapper for Frank in 05.
Yeah, that's good spread there, too. And, again, another name. You know what I mean? It's a you know, they talk about it being a stallion maker's race. And, you know, it's pretty darn good indicator of trainers too. When you look down at the list of guys that have won it, you know, of course the Chief and Jimmy Jerkins and Fletcher's won it, and Hollendorfer and Frankel, like you said, guys like Mandela and Jimmy Kroll and Wayne Lucas, Leroy Jolly, Mac Miller, Woody Stevens, Elliot Birch. I mean, you know, murderer's row of trainers for sure. Guys that I think really are, you know, at the very top of the class of Hall of Famers, even.
No doubt. And I got to say, similarly, on the ownership side, too, actually. You've got nothing but the purplest of families and operations. I mean, it's unbelievable, actually.
Yeah. Isn't our game great, though, that we can kind of dig in and look at just an individual race like that? You know, I think... You know, it's fine and dandy and all to sort of promote different parts of the racing experience and the day at the races and whatever. But, you know, I always say the best thing our game has going for it is sort of its historical traditions. And when you kind of respect that and understand it, I think it makes racing that much better. You know, that's how I learned the game. I learned about, you know, I grew up working at the Fasig Tipton horse sales grounds on the grounds crew cutting grass, but I was fascinated by racing and the history and looking at the names of the placards on the stall doors and trying to learn who were those horses and who bought those horses, who bred those horses. That's how I got into it. You know, I like to go over to these races as a kid and play and, you know, you know, maybe the lessons I learned or self-taught, you know, early on didn't necessarily serve me that well as a horse player. I'm not really that good at it. I could certainly pick winners, but I don't, you know, don't necessarily walk away from the track with tons of money, and nor have I ever claimed to. I love it, and it's really cool. And to be there on a day like Saturday with you know, so much anticipation for the day, and you know, I think a great appreciation from the crowd that day. You know, hearing the crowd cheer the horses come back after the big races. You know, cheering on Hot Rod Charlie coming back after the Belmont, of course, Essential Quality after the race. It was really neat. You know, it felt like a big time event again. You know, and so did the Derby, and so did the Preakness. And I think we're really going to feel it in a few weeks, Saratoga, for sure.
Well, and you can appreciate this. I don't think we talked about it on Saturday, but I've said that, well, I had Seth Merrow yesterday, and I had Andy Serling on Tuesday, and Rich Migliore, actually, now that I think about it, Monday. So there's been direct local ties and New York, you know, very New Yorkish ties each day. And I was just blown away all week by the Saratoga conversation. Everybody.
Yeah.
Tom, I mean, it is really palpable how keyed up everybody is.
Unbelievably. I'll tell you this, and you probably know this as well as anybody. I went, you know, I was on track for all three Triple Crown races. You know, I unfortunately couldn't get to Belmont for as long as I normally do. Without a doubt, everyone that I talked to asked me about what I thought Saratoga was going to be like this summer, you know, and what the atmosphere was like in town, you know, and how excited, and they all mentioned how excited they were to go, you know, whether it's Brett Jones from Airdrie or Brett Calhoun from Trainer and all kinds of other trainers, horsemen, owners, breeders, everybody wanted to talk about it to a person. So
that's right.
I've told other people that, and people in my general life, you know, that non-racing friends that I have, they're excited about it, and they want to know about it, and they have been for months. You know, in the winter, everybody, you know how it is, Steve. Everybody's asking you, what's it going to be like? Are they going to allow fans? Are they going to do this? You know, and they were doing it last year too, obviously. But you know, with the way things are going this year, it's we're shaking up that champagne. I mean, if that cork's going to come off once the racing comes, and it's going to really blow pretty good. You know, and you know, it'll be a good buzz at the beginning, I think. But then, you know, when we get to early August sales time, you know, Saratoga is really made for August, you know, and that's when you're really going to feel it. I think that's when how we felt it the last few years since they had the extended, you know, meet extended out to 8 weeks with the five day racing schedule. We still did, you know, it was cool at the beginning in July, but man, it really gets exciting in August, you know, Whitney weekend. And just like kind of the old, quote unquote, the old Saratoga, you know, the way it was when it was 4 weeks. And, you know, I still think August is still, you know, it's the August place to be.
That's the old thing, right?
That's the one. I grew up with. Yeah.
Me too. And part of that is people that are going to come for the quote unquote the season. And not that there aren't people that are here, you know, by the beginning of the meet. There is that uptick literally, you know, for the first week of August. I think the sale has a lot to do with that too, Tom, right? I mean,
sure.
That's the coordinated arrival, and the Whitney was always at that time. The Whitney had always been, I think, that first Saturday in August as well. Mm-hmm. So that was part of it.
And the Hall of Fame, you know, so you have Hall of Fame on Friday, kind of have the big weekend when all the agents, the owners, the breeders, the, you know, people from around the country, around the world that are in town. Then you have the Whitney, and then you have kind of the two sales days, really. And then it just kind of flows from there. Then you have, then you start getting sort of the urgency. There's only 4 weeks left or whatever, you know, so then you have that built-in urgency based on the calendar, of course, leading up to the Travers, you know, which everybody will be asking about again. Well, we have the Derby winner, we have the Preakness winner, we have the Belmont winner, everybody wants to know that. So that'll be the next sort of series of questions, maybe after after we get really close to opening day.
Well, Tom, we'll probably not talk to you the next couple of weeks, but some thoughts as we look toward the second half. And, you know, they're going to draw the Pegasus for Sunday at Monmouth. Monmouth is going to be really kind of a focus. They put together a nice field for the Salvatore Mile Saturday, but Mandaloon coming back on Sunday, and the Haskell could end up putting together Medina Spirit and Mandaloon in the gate against each other, whoever else is going to show. And then, you know, we've got the New York Avenue that's going to bring Dwyer / Jim Dandy toward Travers. I mean, it really feels like we're poised for a terrific second half.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have horses like Midnight Bourbon maybe coming back, and the Jim Dandy, and First Captain is kind of a exciting horse for Shug and his people. Kind of, you get those horses that are starting to emerge now from that didn't quite make the classics. Or maybe we're on the trail a little bit early and kind of had some setbacks and then start coming back, coming together with the established names from the Triple Crown, and I think a lot of times, some of the, hopefully maybe some of the Eastern races will benefit by getting some of the West Coast horses. They don't really have like a three-year-old program out there, in the summer, like we do here on the East Coast. We're really lucky getting a lot of those Triple Crown horses in the Haskell or the Jim Dandy and the Travers. Kind of their last chance, along with the Pennsylvania Derby there into September. Could be some, still kind of, Central Quality being the champion and kind of winning the Belmont, running a good race, maybe with a little bit of an excuse in the Derby, that at least a lot of people see it as an excuse. He's probably on top. Brad Cox made a statement. He said, well, he's got the belt, he kind of does. So, there for the taking if, somebody else jumps up, with three different winners of the Triple Crown races, and everybody's in the hunt. Mandaloon, maybe Medina Spirit, we shall see. Ron Bauer, could be kind of a cool Travers horse. Travers going to be important like it usually is. And then on to the Breeders' Cup, which is out there at Del Mar this year. So, yeah, second half shaping up, like you said. We'll get started on the second half right now, right? The Pegasus this weekend.
Pretty much, actually, it does. Yeah. We turn the page quickly, undoubtedly.
Yeah. Speaking of history, I heard your talk with Tony Black earlier, talking about some of those Islands with Chief Honcho and Jolie's Halo and those races. I remember those races. Man, I mean, you'd have a field like that now, and people be talking about it like it's the Breeders' Cup Classic, right? I mean, the names that you're throwing out there. I was like, wow, Lost Mountains and all these cool horses. Yeah, that's kind of cool. I remember those races. They were fun.
Well, and that was, the Island, there was a period there where the Island was one of the top, the top. It's still a nice race, but it Skip Away. I remember going to Monmouth for Skip Away's win, and I lived in Brielle. It was the first that was a great period with those handicap horses. Yeah. Well, Tom, I'm gonna bring. Speaking of second half and targets. Going to have Nick Casado join us here. Nick's in the background. So we're going to talk about aiming the Woody Stevens winner toward the Alan Jerkins. Tom, in the meantime, we'll look forward to some summer previewing with you in July.
Absolutely. Sounds good, Steve. Looking forward to it. And good luck with the rest of the show and the rest of the summer. Talk to you soon.
You got it. Tom Law, everybody, and part of the Saratoga special team, of course. This is horseracing.com, and you follow Tom at Saratoga TL is his Twitter address. If you aren't following Tom, you should be. And he's the head of the Turf Writers and Broadcasters, and does a great job on that front. And his writing, his turf writing. And he's been a terrific addition with the Clancy brothers. Standing by is Nick Casado. We talked in February when it seemed, you know, it seemed at that time like Drain the Clock had, you know, potential to be an important three-year-old. And one of the really key elements of the success story, you heard Jay Pribman stress yesterday, and that is, you know, understanding the horse, as Clint Eastwood famously says, a man's got to know his limitations. It doesn't hurt to know your horse's limitations. And when it came to Drain the Clock, the decisions have been savvy. But that's a hallmark of Nick Quesada's career around the game. He joins us now, Slam Dunk and Partners, and the breeder as well, the McLean's Music son, Drain the Clock. Nick, congratulations.
No, Steve, thanks for having me, and thank you so much. Quite a week it was.
It's got to particularly be satisfying for the reason I just laid out. You know, you look at three-year-old seasons, and you know what the opportunities are, and you took your shot going long in the Fountain of Youth. He ran a very nice race, but you said, this is a one-turn horse for now, and that's what we're going to concentrate on, and now he's a grade one winner.
Yeah, you know, it's hard when, you know, you get wrapped up in the Derby, and there's only one Derby every year. And Safi kind of thought, you know what, he really believed that he could train the horse to get a little further distance. And we just sat down and kind of hashed it out and said, you know what, we're not praying for any longer distances than what he ran in the Fountain of Youth. So we just kind of put our thinking caps on and said, you know what, let's just stick to what we know he is really, really good at. And it paid off for all of us.
I want to really get a 360 degree discussion in here, because as I tweeted after the race, to me, part of this story's satisfaction is for you has got to be the breeding side, and to, you know, not just acquire a horse at auction, which is fine, but to pick out an undistinguished mare, you know, that was 0-for-4 in her career, and to fashion her, you know, into a dam, and, you know, to reach for McLean's Music. I mean, talk about the origin story here, with Mankey, and you know, basically making this horse.
Yeah, I bought a few mares off of John Liviakis. I actually watched a horse run one day by the name of Whitmore when he broke his maiden. We all know who Whitmore is now. We didn't then. And it was my first interaction with John trying to buy... I initially contacted Ron Moquette to try to buy Whitmore. I thought I had a deal done with him. It kind of fell through. The horse was going to stay in the barn, and he got a few other owners under his shed row to buy the horse. So I said, you know what, let me see if I can buy his dam, which ended up being Melody Spirit. John initially said he didn't want to sell. 2 weeks later, he came back and said he would sell, so I bought her. Along with her, shortly following her, Mankey ended up becoming available for sale, and a few other of mares that John had that he was breeding. So it was just kind of like by happenstance that all of this came to fruition. And my son and I, along with Rachel Holden at Warhorse Place in Kentucky, we picked the matings, we picked the stallions that we think best suit the mares, and it's just really turned out great for Mankey and for Slam Dunk Racing.
I expect to talk to, probably after the sale now, to talk to John Sakura. It was a remarkable the afternoon and weekend, really, for McLean's music, and continuing right into the sale starting yesterday. But a 1-2 finish in the Woody with Drain the Clock and Jackie's Warrior. And, of course, there had also been the Philly on Friday, when the Better Roses, Estío Talentoso. What attracted you on the mating side to go to McLean's music?
You know, we really, it's kind of a detailed process. We do a lot of nickings and whatnot. But I thought McLean's music was a sensational racehorse. And a year ago, no one wanted a McLean's music. And now you look at him this weekend, especially with Jackie's Warrior and Drain the Clock, he's now a fashionable sire. And John Sakura, I think, is going to hit the ball out of the park with him. I think he's going to be, you know, he is obviously a little distance limited so far, but he's quite sensational in what he throws. I mean, Jackie's Warrior is one hell of a racehorse. You know, to do what he did 3 weeks prior with him and Dream Shake throwing it all the way down the lane together, that had to have a little bit of an impact on the way he ran last Saturday. So, it take nothing away from Jackie's Warrior. I mean, Drain the Clock had to bring his A game. And I think that speaks a lot to the sire.
And you had made the decision after, you know, coming to New York for Wood Memorial undercard action, the Bayshore, and you win the Bayshore, and he won that pretty much in hand at I don't know, 2-5. But you guys didn't get lured into a Pat Day Mile or even the Chick Lang. You know, the grade one was part of this plan. And, you know, you've already referenced the interaction with the people that contribute to the operation, Nick, whether it's you mentioned Rachel Holden and Safi. Clearly, you guys are going about this with purpose and with a, you know, with a plan. And, you know, it's not, let's run here, let's go chase this money. You knew and you know what this opportunity represented, the grade one Woody Stevens, and you made it the priority.
Yeah, we made a plan and we stuck with it. We weren't going to be, there was going to be no deviation. The Pat Day Mile did look like it, you know, it was coming up a little softer than potentially the Woody Stevens could come up. But my son and I especially, we discussed, hey, if a few of these horses knock themselves out in the Pat Day Mile, it's only going to make the Woody Stevens that much softer. And, you know, we went into the Woody Stevens, and people like Andy Serling still didn't give us the credit that I think we deserved. You know, he's kind of the Rodney Dangerfield of the three-year-old division. He just doesn't get the notoriety and the credit that he deserves. He went off at 7-1 on Saturday, and I just don't think... I don't think he gets the respect that he deserves, and now maybe he might.
It certainly didn't hurt. It's going to look a lot different when, you know, whatever the prep or whatever, you know, whenever he shows up next ahead of the Jerkins, it's going to look a lot different with a 97 buyer on the PP line, Nick. That's going to go a long way. And even you know, for those that are looking at numbers, here's the third graph page. He had run three straight fours from the start of the season. He moved forward a little bit in the Bayshore and got a three. And I mean, on sheet numbers, and you're, I don't have to, you know, I'm not going to teach you anything on that. You know, he had been, you know, 2-3 lengths slower coming in than, you know, than the top choices in here, Dream Shake and Jackie. And I think that's the only reason, you know, that he, you know, was being sort of looked at as a second tier 3-year-old sprinter coming in.
Yeah, he you know, but I think, and I'm a big sheets guy. I'm a big rags guy. Have been for gosh 35 years. I'm kind of dating myself when I say that, but I'm coming up on 55 years old, so I guess it is what it is, right, Steve?
Right, exactly.
His numbers were a little below what a lot of the horses were, but I think if you watched his races and how he always, he pretty much won in hand in all those races.
True.
He was never really called on big time in any of those races, so I think you had to factor that in a little bit. You know, I mean, it's easy to say after the fact, right?
Well, and you project. I mean, part of sheet methodology is looking and trying to, you know, trying to see, you know, project and what the, you know, what the pattern might be. And he absolutely, I can tell you on Jerry, on Thorough Pattern, which is a terrific addition that Jerry Brown has added in recent years. It's the percentages of the likelihood, you know, of a horse to pair up or move forward. He was 44% to pair up and 30% to move forward. So there was a, you know, essentially a 74 off of 942 prior starts with horses that had his pattern. He was 74% likely to pair up or go forward. That's a strong position in here. And you know, I think one reason, not that Caddo River went off at a low price. I mean, he was 6-1, but I think people were thinking if he cuts back to 7/8, you know, he could be live. People were looking to Nova Rags, you know, as a horse that was going to get a trip, you know, in behind the speed. So that's how you end up, you know, being a $17 winner. Listen, what do you complain? You and all the partners and everybody are got to be thrilled. You got $17. Come on, who's kidding who?
Yeah. A couple of the guys had a really big day, so we're not at all complaining. And like you said, Steve, the gradual progression with his numbers, even on rags, you know, his race in the Woody Stevens was a 6 3/4, so that still doesn't, like, blow him up numbers-wise compared to what he was running. So that, just like Jerry Brown said, that gradual progression is such a good thing, especially in a 3-year-old, you know, mid-year. So I like everything he's doing. Couldn't be more happy that we have Matt Aquette and Mr. Mark Lohr on board. Safi has done an absolute fantastic job with this colt. And hopefully he becomes a stallion somewhere.
Long way to go on that front. And, you know, you got, of course, you know, you got a chance at all kinds of things, really, when you look ahead to the way the second half of the year unfolds. And, you know, the obvious goal, the goals, plural, I mean, there's so many different things. And particularly with you being West Coast-based, you know, year-end, you think about the Malibu. Backing up, you've got the Breeders' Cup at Del Mar. So you got the sprint right there in the backyard. And coming back to New York in August on Travers undercard, you got the other big grade one opportunity. So there's a calendar that invites a run at a championship here. No.
Yeah. I mean, I can't disagree with anything that you're saying. I mean, it's, you know, you're a student of the game yourself. I mean, you put a lot into the handicapping, and I'm in unison with your thoughts. I mean, I can't disagree with one thing you said, Steve.
Well, and I think everybody gets an idea of what Nick is thinking for the rest of the year. I love it. Talk about what this means to Slam Dunk, and I also want you to talk about the personal satisfaction. I one of the things I cited on Saturday that really grabbed me was, you know, your success, Nick, as a jock agent and as a partnership and owner, a manager, and, you know, now as a breeder. I mean, it's a rare set of, you know, of plaudits and successes. It, you know, from a personal satisfaction standpoint, I'm going to guess you couldn't have imagined at some point that you'd have all of these different kinds of credits.
No, you know, I mean, when you do these things, especially in the breeding game, you kind of just hope to get them to the races. Winning a grade one is just icing on the cake. And I was on a podcast. This was before the grade one. This was after Maxim Rate won her grade one on Memorial Day. And I was asked, what's it like winning races with a homebred versus with just a horse that you buy? And it just kind of came to me when the question was posed. I said, it's like coaching a Little League All-Star team in the Little League World Series. And one of the kids on your team, you being the coach, hits the game-winning home run. That's what it feels like when you buy a grade one winner. When you breed a grade one winner, it would be the equivalent of your son or your daughter on that same team hitting the game-winning home run.
Nice.
It's just a whole nother level. It almost gets me emotional.
Yep.
Because it's so difficult.
No doubt. There's no doubt. And I'm glad you brought up Maxim Raitt, because we certainly were going to, you know, talk about some of the other stable stars. And, you know, that was a wonderful win. That's, of course, a Hertrick Fielding product, the Exchange Raitt mare. And it was, you know, a different kind of level of satisfaction, you know, for Juan Hernandez. I think that was his first grade one, if I recall. Maybe not.
Actually, but it's his second, because I asked
second.
Him that.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go. But it's still, I mean, he seems like he's on an ascension himself, you know, coming down from San Francisco and finding consistent success in Southern California. So it you know, the whole slam dunk, you know the horses you've sent east, people getting more and more familiar, you know, with the name, and of course the you know, familiar jacket, the black and orange and blue, the basketball. I mean, it you've really become a national presence, and it felt like this past 10 days was an incredible coming out party.
Yeah, it has been. You know, we've kind of vacillated on doing some advertising, and what happened this week is the ultimate advertisement. You can't do better, but we're going to start trying to grow this thing to even bigger. A lot of people think that Slam Dunk is just a small group of people that I put together, and we're content with being small, kind of a boutique-like racing partnership. But in truth, I want to grow this thing to be big, so we're welcoming all partners to join. I want to make Slam Dunk the premier racing partnership, if not in America, certainly California.
Well, you know, we talked, and we, you've been on it at least two, three times at a minimum, and what I said, I think, in February and even in prior visits, is that you know, you've got kind of a unique, you come at this with a slightly unique vantage point, and your work as a jock agent, that, you know, that gives you I would have to feel a leg up, you know, not that there aren't countless people, you know, involved in ownership operations that understand the game, but a jock agent perspective is unique, and it's special, because you don't operate with, you know, a blue sky at all times philosophy. You are much more capable of tempering expectations and I'm sure telling partners, you know, this is where this horse can win, and we're not going to, you know, we're not going to bang our heads against the wall. We're gonna run where we can be successful, and I'm sure that, you know, bringing that perspective to this, that's not necessarily something that you get everywhere.
No, I like to take a hard line stance approach to where, you know, I think placement is huge. Like you just said, you know, I would say that's a good agent's biggest asset, knowing where horses belong, because when you are an agent, knowing where horses belong pretty much is where the horses you choose to ride. So I think that's the biggest asset that I bring to Slam Dunk, is knowing where to place horses. And I'm not big on blowing sunshine either. I'm pretty straight with the partners in terms of where their horses belong. We all like them to be as great a horses as they can be, but we have to be realistic by the same token.
Exactly.
So, you know, everything's going great. I have no complaints at all, and I hope we just keep growing, keep winning these type of races, and I hope to have, you know, you have me on the show every week.
Well, talk about you know, where you stand and you know, what the, you know, what the roster looks like. I mean, it is, you are at a point in the season where two-year-olds are going to start to show up, and certainly Del Mar, the big part of the program. I mean, how do you approach it in terms of roster building beside the ones that you're breeding? How many mares, for instance, how many horses are you breeding yourself right now?
I have 9 mares that I own myself. So that gets to be 27 horses real quickly. They're like rabbits. This year we have 12 two-year-olds. Not all of them will be at Del Mar. Some are in Florida with Safi. But we have Vertical Threat coming back off a layoff. Tonalist Shape, she came back. She didn't fire her best shot in her comeback race. Hopefully she kind of turns the corner and gets back in form for us in Florida. But I'm looking to have a very, very strong Del Mar and a great summer.
I can direct people, slamdunkracing.com, for information, and you can, you know, you can reach out to Nick also through Twitter. You can follow the stable that way, and of course you and your son. And when it comes to the trainers, you know, you mentioned Safi, but think about Richard Baltus, of course, right? And
Baltus, D'Amato.
D'Amato, yep.
We have a couple with Simon Callahan in California, so that's kind of the bulk of our trainers for now.
So, and of course, with Safi getting a shed in New York too, he's put a beachhead into Naira, into the circuit.
Yes, absolutely. He'll be, I don't know how many stalls he's going to get at Saratoga, but he was working on that yesterday as we were speaking on the phone. We have this. I'm a little distracted now, and that's, I apologize when your man called me earlier. We're working this OBS sale at the current moment.
And me too.
So
I'm watching.
A little distracting.
No problem. I've been doing the same thing. Luckily, the ones we're looking at are a little later in the day. But Nick,
we need to talk about that because I didn't know you owned.
We've got just a little. We have a fun thing with, you know, I started it as originally as a no fee, you know, $500 buy-in to give people experience and have a taste. And, you know, Chuck Simon and Gary Siaka down in Florida, Susan Ditter's got one, Gary's got 3. You know, but it's more or less an entree. You know, we just have fun and win a couple of races a year. And also because to me it's important, you know, we've got a couple of mares and it's important that, you know, when I talk about these topics, that we've got, you know, skin in the game. You have to experience this and to understand what everybody else is going through. Because it's so unique. I mean, there's nothing like this. And that's why, you know, when you say you get emotional thinking about what you accomplished on Saturday, I completely understand. I mean, when, you know, the mare that we won with at Saratoga, when her baby, Carlisle Bell, when she broke her maiden, it felt like just a special, unique accomplishment that was unlike anything else we had done for just that reason. It was second generation. I mean, it was the first we had bred, but it was, you know, it was one of our first, you know, one of our first purchases, et cetera, first horses that we got, you know, established the stable. So it's important that you have these experiences and it makes everything else about the game, you know, it helps you just, understand the, you know, the emotion, because it's not like anything else.
Yeah, and I've pushed all in with Slam Dunk. So that also brings a little, you know, emotion out. It's like, you know, a lot of these partnerships, the managing partner has no skin in the game. I have major skin in the game. This is like, I'm all in. I mean, I don't have a chip in front of me that's not in the hand. So, you know, that makes it more, it brings out the emotion. It also, you know, it heightens the stress level. But I'm a passionate guy about the game. You know that. I'm an all or nothing guy. I don't do anything at 50 miles an hour. So just happy with the results we've had, and hopefully the trend continues.
Well, Nick, we hope and expect to see you. I don't know how I missed you on Saturday, but I did. And looking forward to having you at Saratoga. And I can say we'll be at Del Mar, too, this summer for a few days, as a matter of fact. So
well,
one way or another, I'll see you soon.
Upset if you do.
Absolute. Nick Cassato, everybody, and Slam Dunk Racing. You can follow Nick, and you can follow Slam Dunk, and visit slamdunkracing.com if you'd like to talk to Nick about getting involved with him and his son and all their partners. And he's, you know, he's working with all the best people around the game, and he's somebody who got tremendous respect for what he's accomplished here, and it's a unique accomplishment what he's done. So thanks to Nick for visiting, and we'll let him go. Let's see, hip 367 in the ring. So,
thanks for having me, bud.
Nick, thank you. We'll see you soon. Nick Cassato, everybody. We'll stay here. We got about 8-9 minutes. Rich Eng, I want to get Rich in here so he and I can quickly kind of walk through the pick six with you a little bit, see if what his opinions are, and we'll also get his thoughts about the end of the Triple Crown season. The pick six sequence in New York starts at 4:40 today, and the TV show actually is 3 to 8:30. Fox, the America's Day at the Races, because of the twilight action, both at Churchill and at Belmont. So you've got, you know, if you're saying to yourself, oh, I didn't have time to handicap, you got plenty of time, because this pick six starts with race four at 4:40. Rich Eng, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Rich, I just we're going to look at the any opinions you've got in New York today. But before we do that, your Triple Crown epilogue. What was your take?
Well, it was an unusual one, to say the least. We saw some stuff we haven't seen in a long time. But you know, I want to look forward almost more than looking back, because when I worked in the New York Racing Association, I remember in 1981, we had a historic Travers where we had the three winners of the different Triple Crown races get together. We had Conquistador Cielo and Loma's Ruler and Gato del Sol, and it was the first time that had happened in a very long time, Steve. And of course, for those old enough to remember, another horse won that race. It was a horse called Runaway Groom won. So I'd love to see all these Triple Crown winners, or the Triple Crown race winners from this year, get together. But heck, there might be four of them instead of three.
That's a good point. We'll see. You know, we'll see. By the time we get to the Haskell, who knows? Mandaloon is going to enter today for the Pegasus at Monmouth on Sunday, and then we'll look toward August and getting down to Monmouth. I always, it's one of my favorite experiences every year, is being down at Oceanport, and the Haskell's going to be big. Rich, terms of your action, how'd the picks and plays come out?
Yeah, pretty good. I've got a simulcast sheet available at racedaylasvegas.com. I do have a couple of picks at Belmont on the sheet. Only one of them's in the pick six, but it came at the end of the card in race nine. I selected number two, Valeria, Mike Maker, with Luis Saez. The horse kind of ran evenly last time off the claim, but I think there's improvement in this horse. So at 5-1, I thought it was a square price in the finale, last leg of the pick six.
Let me hold on. There we go. Voliero, Michael Dubb, and this is one that they took from Jim Bond. Mm-hmm. And actually kind of came back and ran really a very similar race to the one that they when they claimed this gelding. This is a four-year-old, and of course, you know, we're at the time of the year where the three-year-olds and the four-year-olds are mixing it up, and so you do get, you know, you do get the older facing the younger, and because of it, there's a 7-pound swing. The three-year-olds are at 118 and the four-year-olds are at 125. You know, for instance, the horse on the inside, Grand Motion, has got that Chulean, a Cantheros that has been gelded and gets first Lasix, was last seen in September, and Manny Franco gets aboard 10-1, and I thought that Chulean had a bit of a of an interest with natural improvement from 2-3. I thought this horse was okay in here.
Yeah, you know, the draw from maiden special to a maiden claiming is always something that you have to take note of. Another horse doing that same move is the four horse for Christophe Clément, debuted at maiden special going short at 6 furlongs, but now goes a mile and drops down to maiden claiming, gets Rosario, which always makes a horse dangerous. So there's another horse that has a similar chance to move forward on the drop.
That's you're talking about Dressed for the Fifth, and this a Malibu Moon. You know, the horse of Rudy's as well, 3-1, one of the choices, Ghostmon. This is a Ghost Zapper, and it really has looked okay in those two tries at the level, 3-1, and you don't want a horse like this to, you know, to keep going too far without winning, but certainly, you know, both of those races, any improvement off of those, and Ghostmon is a player in here, and you know, Gary's got this Dream Point that I happened to see her work. I get, was it last week? I guess it was last weekend, and coming out of a very good effort, actually. Dream Point, 4-1. Gets Jose Ortiz today. So this is a tricky nightcap, which is not unusual. They Naira very frequently drops this state bred maiden 40s at you, and they're tough.
But the one thing I like to see, Steve, is you know, we've kind of had a dearth of field sizes at Santa Anita, so it's nice to see a double-digit size field for ones to sink my handicapping teeth into. And, you know, I lean more toward the two at a square price. I thought Louis Reyes might be able to get a nice rail trip, and, you know, saving ground and on Belmont turf is always an angle that the jockeys try to practice to give themselves a better chance to win.
It's a very tricky sequence as it happens, and that includes the feature, the first level allowance, 1.25 miles on the grass on the inner turf course. So it's essentially a single circuit, and this is brutal. Tony Dutrow has got that 3-1 shot, High Opinion. Joe Bravo gets aboard, and High Opinion, I guess nominally is the horse to beat. You know, Chad's got one coming out of that maiden breaker, going back to April, also at the trip, the 1.25 miles. So, you know, Higher Truth okay in here, but you know, beyond those two, the next four look about the same. You've also got Grand Motion, a first North America try, made in Italy. This for Aaron Wellman's Eclipse and Partners. Kind of interesting. Has got a, you know, series of just sort of nondescript works at Fair Hill. So I thought the feature was a little tricky. It's actually a co-feature because the eighth has got a bunch going 7-8. As well, including some familiar horses like Mios for Jimmy Jerkins and Centennial. What was your other play before the pick?
Actually, I do want to make a comment in the eighth race. I looked at a horse very strongly. I didn't put the horse on my list, but I still might play out of pocket. But the number five, Jalen Journey, had a tough time last time out, and Steve Asmussen thought enough of this horse to actually go to Maidan with this horse. So I really think this is a wake up possibility if you're looking to try to isolate somebody. But the five, Jalen Journey, tough trip last time, should have a better trip today, hopefully.
In the third, before the pick six starts, it's just the maiden special. These are two-year-olds, and it's a six-pack. There is some breeding here, and curious, just kind of funny. Chad Brown and Seth Klarman have got Gerrymander, a $375,000 Into Mischief, and it happens to be a sibling, a half, to Lone Rock, who won the Brooklyn on Saturday. And you've also got a sibling here. Is it the five? Velvet, I think. Is it Velvet Sister or is it Amazing Dream? Somebody else. It's Velvet Sister. The five, the Stone Street $500,000 Bernardini, that's a half to My Boy Tate, who was a very nice New York bred as well. And this is a New York bred that Michelle Nevin and Godolphin co-bred together. So that's an interesting third. We're in the second with Kid Chocolate. A little bit tough. He's down the pecking order, but he should run all right. Manny back aboard. So safe trip to Manny and the kid today in the second. Rich Eng, everybody. Rich Eng for Pro Pick. RaceDayLasVegas.com for Rich's daily analysis. And getting geared up, of course, for the end of Santa Anita and the start of the Del Mar summer. Rich, good luck today. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Talk to you next week.
You got it. Rich Eng, everybody. Nick Casado. Tony Black. Dick Powell. And Ray Arsenault, one of the two new NHC Hall of Fame members. I'll write up the pick six. It's not up there yet. I've been kind of waiting for the scratches. I thought I'd wait for that. All right, so I'll have it up probably by 2:30 or so. Good luck tomorrow. Weekend preview. Talk to you then. Thanks, everybody.
Racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.